May it please the court. My name is Thomas Gagan. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff's appellants, Charles Daniels and the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. And may I state the case as follows. First of all, this is an old technology, not a new technology case, but a very important one just the same, because it involves the very fundamental rights of locomotive engineers who are professionals. Some of them, the BLET represents 20, 30-year employees who have lost their licenses, had their professional, full licenses, their Class 1 certificates, taken away without any prior hearing, without any post-deprivation hearing, without any hearing ever at any time as to whether their professional, full professional licenses, their full Class 1 certificates, should have been taken away. And at no point, and this is the most important thing to stress in this appeal, at no point do these engineers ever receive a hearing, whether from Union Pacific or from the FRA later or anywhere, as to whether the original Class 1 certificates that they have, their full professional licenses, should have been taken away. No post-deprivation hearing ever occurs.
Now, all the, yes. I think we know that. What I want to ask you is, wouldn't this case have been a lot simpler if you had filed two petitions, as they did in John Doe versus DEA? In other words, if you'd gone to the district court, appealed that, and then filed a petition for review before us, as far as the Hobbs Act?
You mean file two cases, one under the Hobbs Act and one in the district court simultaneously? Well, that's quite possible because as the court is aware from the appendix, the FRA just decided the Hensley appeal. The reason we didn't bring the Hobbs Act case, Mr. Daniels' case under the Hobbs Act, is that there wasn't any order for the court to review under the Hobbs Act. All that the FRA decided in the Daniels appeal is that he was properly denied his recertification from student. And the Hobbs Act says that the Court of Appeals has the power to enjoin, suspend, or set aside any final agency action by the FRA. Well, there was never any final resolution by the FRA as to whether Mr. Daniels' original full professional license had been properly taken away. They just took a punt on it. So there wasn't a final resolution of that question that could have been brought before the Court of Appeals.
Isn't that necessarily what they did? That is, they revoked his Class 1 certification. Now, they say they demoted him, and we don't have, as far as I can tell, we don't have the notification that they gave him saying you are demoted. I don't know what, we don't, do we? It's in the district court record, I think.
Your Honor, the FRA never revoked his license. Union Pacific did. And the FRA never made any decision as to whether or not Union Pacific was acting properly. It never decided that issue. It said it can't decide that issue. That issue is not within its jurisdiction, which is completely backwards because the FRSA 20135A says that the Secretary has total power in this area. It is not the Union Pacific that acts, you know, unless there's a regulation. The Secretary has the total power, and Union Pacific can't act unless there's some authority conferred upon it by the Secretary. The Secretary, or the FRA, has it all wrong. Their view is, well, unless we are given the power to act by specific regulation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we can't do anything in this area. It's the opposite. Under a licensing and certification program, under licensing, the agency runs it from soup to nuts, like the FAA does with pilots. Under a certification program, the Secretary empowers or entrusts the carrier to act as a surrogate.
Let me just stop you, and yes. Tell me if I'm wrong. Under 240.307, a railroad that certifies a person as a qualified locomotive engineer, which it had done with respect to Daniels.
Yes.
All right. And that during the period that it's valid, which is undisputed, it acquires or whatever information that convinces it no longer meets, that the person no longer meets the qualifications, that is, these rides they went on, shall revoke the person's certificate. Now that says the railroad does it. And then pending it, suspended and so on, and the hearing is all the hearing requirements are set forth. Now, as I understand it, and I don't think it's in the record, how the railroad notified Mr. Daniels that he was being demoted. But whatever the railroad said, there's no provision for that, for demotion, is there?
No. And
I mean, the only way they could act is through 24307, because he was a person with a, he was a qualified locomotive engineer. That certification was valid. And whether they acquired information, that is, the railroad that made them think it was, he was no longer qualified, they could only revoke it.
That's correct. We agree. And in addition, under 307, 240307, they had to have a hearing within 10 days. The FRA and the Union Pacific have claimed in the district court and in the administrative process, well, we aren't revoking anything. You still have your student license. It's like, well, you know, you can still take the bar exam in law school, but we're kicked out as a lawyer.
That's where you threw me off, is when you said it's not a Hobbs Act, because the FRA has to do the revocation, and this has nothing to do with the railroad. I mean, where does it go? Let's say they did revoke it, and Union Pacific. Then what happens?
What we have been doing, what the BLET has been doing, has been appealing this to the Locomotive Engineer Review Board and saying this was not proper. They didn't follow the procedures. The LERB has said, and that's why we joined them as a defendant, this isn't revocation, this isn't our jurisdiction. We go up to the administrative hearing officer, Mr. King, who has said, who first time with Mr. Daniels, refused to discuss the issue. We don't know why, he just refused to discuss the issue. Then in the Hensley decision, he said, I have no power to decide this. This is not a revocation. It does not fit, as I understand it, as a revocation under the federal regulations, because they still have a student certificate, so they've got some kind of license. They've got a beginner's permit, so they haven't really had their license revoked. Well, we've said that's a pretext, that's ridiculous. We've gone up, and this has not been put in the record because it's just been decided, and we can add it to the record, but the Federal Railroad Administrator on February the 1st upheld Mr. King's decision, which we have attached in the appendix, on the same grounds, just saying,
Hensley.
Pardon?
This is Hensley.
Hensley, yes. And we will add that. The court can take judicial notice of it. This is, so we could go and appeal right now the Hensley decision. But what's, to a certain extent, what's the point? You know, under the Hobbs Act, this court has the power to suspend, enjoin, set aside an order. The order being an order that we can't decide this case. It is much more efficient under these circumstances to bring this case in district court under the Marbury versus Madison, Hubbard versus EPA, recognized jurisdiction of this court to enjoin constitutional claims. We're aware that this court, this circuit, has a case law that says you can't always do that if you're trying to interrupt an ongoing adjudication. But as Your Honor understands, there's no adjudication going on. They refuse to adjudicate whether the license was taken away, so we aren't disrupting anything. This is the opposite of the cases they cite. We're trying to get an adjudication going, and they're refusing to have one. So that's why we're in complete agreement that, of course, this is a revocation of the license. It's certainly felt that way by the engineer. And we're very interested in getting before the district court, which we think is the more efficient forum to getting this resolved, because it is such a broad-based practice. There are, we cited six people, but there are other people, many other people who are affected, and other engineers who've been affected by this decision, as discovery would bring out.
Why is the denial of the hearing that is required under 240.307 not a final action? And that's where we started, I think. And I think you answered because the hearing was not denied by the agency. It was denied by the railroad. So my question to you is, does it matter what, I guess it does to you, does it matter the basis that the federal agency used to say no hearing? That is, whether they say, we can't even decide this, because they said, in effect, we don't have jurisdiction over demotion,
And Your Honor is correct that it's possible to raise that claim under the Hobbs Act, but it's a very awkward way of proceeding. And it's much more efficient when you're trying to get an injunction, not setting aside an order that says we can't decide whether or not to decide. What's the Court of Appeals going to do? Send it back and say, well, you do have the jurisdiction to decide it. I mean, all they've decided at the moment is that they don't have the jurisdiction to decide whether or not there's a constitutional violation.
But what you want is a hearing before them.
Oh, of course.
You don't want the trial. I mean, you want the hearing.
Well, we want a hearing on the property, actually, before Union Pacific. They have a neutral officer who is supposed to hear the evidence, and there's a record. That's so important. You can't determine why they revoked it without a hearing record. That's what 307 is designed to provide. That's what we aren't getting.
If it's possible to raise this under the Hobbs Act, and I think you just acknowledged that it was, don't you still have the jurisdictional problem?
If you can raise it under the Hobbs Act, you can only raise the Baroque issue as to whether or not the agency was right in deciding it had no jurisdiction to decide the issue. What we want to do after 7 years of being in the internal processes, we want to enjoin what is a constitutional violation that relates not to the merits of any individual order, but to the practices and procedures of the FRA that affect, we list six people, but there are actually dozens of engineers who have been affected by this. This is irreparable injury. It's a constitutional violation at a procedural stage relating to a procedural collateral matter that has nothing to do with the merits as to whether or not any specific license should be revoked. It's an emergency, and that's why we're in district court, and appropriately so, because we're not interfering with the adjudication on the merits as to whether any engineer's particular license should or should not be revoked. That's beside the point here. It's just what the procedures are that they should use. And there's an urgency when pre-hearing rights are deprived like this. My time is.
All right, we'll give you some time.
Okay.
Ms. Borum?
May it please the court, Marion Borum from the United States Attorney's Office. I will argue the government's portion of this appeal, and Mr. Monroe will present the argument on behalf of Union Pacific.
Do you want to move that a little closer to your face?
It appears that the heart of this case is whether the district court correctly concluded that this was a case under Telecommunications Research and Action Center versus the Federal Communications Commission, or TRAC, and that pursuant to the Hobbs Act, jurisdiction lies in the Court of Appeals. The Hobbs Act, read jointly with 49 United States Code 20114C, vests exclusive jurisdiction in the Court of Appeals to enjoin, set aside, or to determine the validity of all final actions of the Secretary of Transportation. So any final action of the federal appellees in this matter should have been brought in the Court of Appeals, and the district court was correct in dismissing this action for lack of jurisdiction. Moreover, in no event would the district court have had jurisdiction over this case because Daniels and the other appellants failed to exhaust their administrative remedies. The administrative process was not complete at the time of the filing of their suit in district court, which would have stripped the district court of jurisdiction had jurisdiction there been proper in the first place. To the extent that the administrative process is now complete for Mr. Daniels, any jurisdiction would necessarily be in the Court of Appeals.
That inconsistent to say there's no final action under Hobbs, and yet they failed to exhaust their administrative remedies. That's one question. Another question I have is, they're really arguing that there was a failure to act. I mean, they went through all the different levels, but each official was saying, I either don't have the power, or this is a demotion that isn't entitled to any sort of procedural due process.
Well, there wasn't a failure to act. When Daniels brought his appeal before the LERB, his question was whether it was not about the reclassification from a Class 1 status to a Class 3 status. His appeal was based upon his recertification, his lack of recertification, not the initial reclassification from Class 1 to Class 3 status. And so at the LERB, they decided the denial of his certification. And then at the administrative hearing officer, they again decided the denial of his recertification. And when it came to the FRA administrator, he indicated that he couldn't decide this new basis that Daniel was bringing for appeal. His new basis was whether the reclassification was proper or not. That was never heard at the LERB, and it wasn't heard before the administrative hearing officer. So in effect, he changed his basis of appeal once he got to the Federal Railroad Administrator. With respect to any Bivens argument that appellants have brought up, Bivens claims clearly cannot proceed against government entities or private corporations. The district court properly held that Union Pacific wasn't a state actor, and Mr. Monroe will discuss that argument further. If there are no further questions of the court, federal appellees ask that the decision of the district court be affirmed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Donald Monroe for Union Pacific. We certainly agree with the United States that the jurisdictional problem with the lawsuit here is the primary basis in which to uphold the district court. If you agree with that, you need go no further. I would simply add to the points made by my colleague from the U.S. Attorney's Office that while the appellants here certainly passionately argue that they really want to proceed in the district court, it is the obligation of the courts to examine the nature of the claim that they're bringing and determine whether it is, in fact, a challenge to the source of the agency's authority to act or not. If it is not a constitutional challenge to the source of the agency's authority, then it doesn't matter how badly they want to be in district court. The district court does not have jurisdiction. The Hobbs Act says that the Court of Appeals jurisdiction is exclusive, and it's not optional. It's not a matter of how badly they want to be in the district court or not. And moreover, this court has explained in the past that it's not simply a matter of accepting the characterization by the plaintiffs of what their claim is. You know, we intend to argue a broad pattern or practice claim. It doesn't matter how they characterize it. Rather, the court should make an independent assessment of what they've actually alleged in the district court. And if you look at the complaint in this case, you can't say with a straight face that it's a challenge to the source of the agency's authority. It's entirely within the context of Mr. Daniels and the other individuals' complaints. They ask for individual relief as to those individuals. And that means it's squarely within the track decision, Time Warner, other decisions by this court that say that has to go to the Court of Appeals. I'd add, in addition, that principle that you should independently examine what the claim is consistent with the caution that this court issued in John Doe, where it said that we really don't want to be creating lots of exceptions to the direct review statutes, lots of judicially created exceptions, because that simply encourages forum shopping. Rather, the parties should have clear indications ab initio, ex ante, where they should go. And as the law currently stands, it's very clear that this sort of claim, challenging either the action of the FRA or its failure to act, has to go to the Court of Appeals. I'll just say one word about state action.
Before you get to that, let me ask you just about this demotion. Is there anywhere in the record that we can see where there's a procedure set out or where Union Pacific has given anybody notice that their Class 1 certificate can be subject not only to revocation and suspension before the hearing, but that they can be demoted?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe there's anything in the record concerning that point, and there's a good reason for that. That's a merits question. I mean, that's the question that the appellants wanted to argue in the district court, and that, frankly, my opponent has argued to this court. He's arguing the merits as if well, it doesn't really matter how we got here. We're in the Court of Appeals now. Please decide the claim. And the point is they did not go through the correct process to bring that claim to this court. As far as I know, there is no indication in the record as to what the exact form of
the. All right, well, let me go outside the record then and ask you, you know, what does Union Pacific do to notify people that their Class 1 certificate, in addition to being revoked, can be demoted, or they can be demoted?
This is based on my own understanding and not anything that I've discussed with my client, but as I understand it, they simply tell people that your certificate is being revoked and it's being replaced with a student certificate. With respect to state action, I'll say only that they rely on the exclusive governmental function test, and the only case that they can cite that comes out the way they want on that point is West v. Atkins, which is completely different from this scenario. It's a case where a physician is given exclusive control over medical care to inmates, a clear state responsibility. And the state has nothing more to do with it. He is their sole actor. Here, by contrast, the government retains the power to review whatever it is that Union Pacific does. It just makes a threshold determination, and they retain the right to say yes or no. And the only scenario that I can think of that is parallel to that is the Railway Labor Act, where the National Arbitration Board retains the power to review on the property decisions by the railroad. And in those, there's a wealth of authority under that statutory scheme explaining that the initial on the property decision by the railroad is not state action. No constitutional challenge can be brought to that.
Are these people out of time if they've got to bring it in the Court of Appeals, Mr. Daniels and the other?
Mr. Daniels would be. I don't believe that some of these other individuals would be. I accept counsel's representation. I haven't independently investigated it, but if there is now final agency action with respect to Mr. Hensley, then they could bring a proper jurisdictional action in this court for review and get the issue decided.
Hubbard versus EPA and Spagnola say that a district court retains its jurisdiction to enjoin constitutional violations. Time Warner and others put limits on that when it might interfere with an ongoing adjudication. Our point here, there is nothing that requires the district court, from a practical point of view, from staying its hand to allow exhaustion in this case when the agency has already said that it's taking no jurisdiction over this, it doesn't want to get involved in this issue, it's going to let Union Pacific do what it wants to do, and when it all relates to a collateral procedural matter which does involve irreparable injury, like in the Matthews versus Eldridge case. If the litigant doesn't have to exhaust, Your Honor, then there's never going to be any final agency action, and the Hobbs Act isn't going to apply for that reason. That, to plaintiffs, is how you reconcile those two lines of cases, because this is the way to get before the court, the district court, which is, under McNary versus Haitian refugees, the preferred way of dealing with a broad-based agency, shall we say, misfunction or screw-up, getting it in a form where it makes more sense than in the Court of Appeals. And given that there is a basis for not requiring exhaustion here, it's our view that the Hobbs Act should not apply. There really is no final agency action in the sense of a resolution of the merits of the revocations that are involved in this case. We are seeking injunctive relief that the Court of Appeals can't give. The Court of Appeals can't hold status hearings to see how its injunction is going and so forth. This is a case that properly belongs in the district court if there is no reason to require exhaustion. And there is no reason to require exhaustion.
Thank you.